Good morning. Good to see everyone here. Happy Memorial Day weekend. So about 20 years ago, I was thinking about this morning, it might be exactly 20 years ago, in late May, Memorial Day weekend, I was with my family up in the Boundary Waters. A place I know many of us have been here. I was up in the Boundary Waters on a canoe trip, and we were about three lakes in, if I remember right. And one evening we were getting ready to go to bed, and it was an especially clear night, and my sister and I started having a conversation that seemed to want to continue after everybody went to bed, so we kept talking. And we kind of let the conversation wander for a couple hours, and if my memory serves, it was about midnight, and we decided to take the canoe out in the middle of the lake, because it was the right time in the conversation to do that, and because it was one of these magic nights that was, you know, 75 degrees, no clouds, absolutely no light pollution, and the stars. You guys have had experiences like that, right, where you can see the Milky Way, you know, the spread there. And we took the canoe out in the middle of the lake and talked for a while, and then we kind of just floated. We just floated and looked up at the sky. And what I remember about that experience, well, I remember really feeling very close to my sister, Molly. But what I also remember was, at that time, 20 years ago in my life, I was right in the middle of two really different things. I knew the life I had left before the summer was not going to come again. And I knew what I was stepping into that fall was going to be radically different. So I was kind of one of those crossroad experiences, you know. And it was for her, too. She was about to leave for many months to live in China. And so, you know, I'm sort of staring at the sky, and we stopped talking and just sort of floated. Floating, by the way, is a fantastic way of looking at the sky, because you're not stable, right? Your whole body is sort of rocking gently. I don't know why that's more evocative, but it was for me. And what I remember about my experience was I was very caught, because of our conversation, in the narrative of my life. I knew I was in this crossroads, and I was very caught by the narrative of where I had been. I was very caught by the narrative of what I thought I was stepping into, where the meaning was in those things. Was what I was about to engage in meaningful? And when I was staring at the infinity, none of those ideas would stick. None of those ideas would stick in the face of a landscape like that. The scale of human life doesn't make sense anymore. And I want to say I felt really, really, really small, which is true. But, you know, when you feel that connected to the infinity, you feel really, really huge too, strangely, right? Because your boundary of self starts getting kind of gauzy. And all I really realized was the questions that I normally framed for myself around relationships, jobs, activities having meaning or no meaning kind of didn't really work in the face of that, in the face of that infinity. It really stuck with me, that experience. I thought about it a lot. And so a couple weeks ago I was at Holy Angels High School speaking on Buddhism. We get a lot of requests for that type of stuff here at Zen Center from colleges and high schools and churches and stuff. I want people to come out and talk to them about Buddhism. And so I was talking to a world religions class, and it was the first period of the day. It started at 7:25, and so all the students are sort of sleepily and reluctantly filing in to the classroom there for first period, and I'm sitting up in the front of the room on a stool, and I'm kind of just sitting there. And as all these students are filing in, this big senior saw me sitting there, and he said, "You're the Zen guy, right?" And I said, "Yep." He said, "All right, what's the meaning of life?" And my answer was very sudden, and it surprised me. I said, "No meaning, just life. No meaning, just life." And I liked that guy. I kind of liked his audacity. And I thought, ooh, audacity is kind of a quality we prize here at Zen Center, right? You get to ask the huge question. That's the point of spaces like this, right? To ask the big question. And I probably also liked him because, you know, in high school I probably would have been that guy. Like, all right, Mr. Fancy Pants. Give me the biggie. So I liked him for asking it, and what's the meaning of life? What a wonderful question. And the funny thing is, at least what occurred to me in that moment was, from a Zen point of view, which is really no point of view at all, what's the meaning of life isn't the big question. That isn't the big question. And that's because in order to ask a question like that, and in order to begin to answer a question like that, we have to have a point of view, we have to have a framework, we have to have a starting point, we have to have a cultural understanding, we have to have a definition. And, you know, generally speaking, when all those things show up, Zen pitches them. You know what I mean? Oh, that's interesting, you have a lens through which you view. Oh, that's interesting, you have a cultural predilection to understand. Oh, that's interesting, you have a definition. Let's take all those things away. They keep you from seeing the night sky. They keep you from seeing the night sky. So so I looked this up, and I thought, well, I better spend some time with this word meaning. And all I will say to you briefly is the word meaning is understood in a lot of different ways. So I encourage you to spend time with this on your own and see where this path leads you. But where I started was Webster's Dictionary. It's a good place to start anything. It's actually amazing to me how much the roots of words, etymology, can show us about how we relate to sound, how we relate to word. I'm not sure why that is, but I've been amazed over the years how often I'm surprised by the origins. Anyway, Webster says meaning is significance, importance, the end toward which something is moving, or its purpose. And all those things, significance, importance, the end to which something is going, its purpose, all those things are bound by culture. They are personal. They are relative. And they're changing all the time. They're changing all the time. And if we think about our own lives, it doesn't take much reflection to realize the significance, importance, and purpose of activities, relationships, and things change over the course of our lives radically. And the things that would have given your life, quote-unquote, meaning when you were five might be really different than the things that gave your life, quote-unquote, meaning when you were 25 or 55 or 75. The significance of a relationship, the significance of an activity, those things are really fluid, aren't they? They're really changing a lot. So, because those things are bound by culture, because they are bound by our momentary understanding, because they are bound by time, they can't be the big question. They can't be the big question, because the big question has to be timeless. It has to be universal. It has to go across cultures. It has to go across races. It has to go across genders. It has to go across ages. It has to be the night sky. Suzuki Roshi said in a Dharma talk that he was giving in July of 1970, he was talking about Zen ritual. And he said, "The actual feeling of rituals cannot be understood without doing them. When you do them, you have the actual feeling of ritual. As long as you try to know what it means or why you do it, it is difficult to feel your actual being in this place. That's a really interesting turn of phrase. As long as you try to know what it means or why you do it, it is difficult to feel your actual being in this place. And I think this works for our lives, too. The actual feeling, the actual experience of life can get lost with too much analysis. As long as we try to know what our life means, why we're here, it's difficult to feel our actual being in this place. Feel your actual being. I think that's kind of a four-word description of Buddhism. Feel your actual being. I like that a lot. Feel your actual being. So that's before the storyline, before the interpretation. It's also interesting to me that the Buddha never taught about meaning. He never offered one. He taught the origin and the cessation of suffering. And that's not meaning. That's an instruction, certainly, on how to live with greater freedom, compassion, joy. It's how to hurt less, how to help others to hurt less. It's interesting to me that Christ never taught about meaning either. He never offered one. He taught people to love. Love all creation, love each other. That's not meaning. That's an instruction on how to live with greater freedom, compassion, joy, how to hurt less, and to help others to hurt less. So why don't great teachers teach on meaning? Why don't they tell us what it is? And why does Zen throw out ideas about meaning as soon as they show up? I suggest it's because meaning is too small. Because meaning is changing all the time. Because meaning is a moving target. Because meaning and all of its variations is essentially an ego story. Meaning is an ego story. And that isn't to say it does not have a place, because it does. And that isn't to say that its place isn't important and helpful, because I think it is. But it's still a small place, relatively speaking, and it has limited function because it's still ego. It's still ego, and ego, as Zen teaches us, is important. It's a tool. Tim calls it a necessary fiction. It's necessary, it's important. But it's still small. It's actually the smallest part of who we are. It's the smallest part of who we are, our ego. And we usually don't feel that. We usually think it's all of who we are. Therefore, the biggest. And then we get the sense through Zen practice, maybe there's something else. Maybe there's another way of knowing that isn't filtered through, what do I want, what do I don't want, what do I want, what do I don't want, what do I want, what do I don't want. And the longer we practice, the more we get to sense, actually, that part of us that is unfiltered is infinite. And the part of us that, what do I want, what do I don't want, what do I want, is actually really small. We become less and less and less identified with that narrative all the time. Less and less and less identified, right, with our conditioned self. And meaning is a function of that limited sense, of self. And to me, meaning and wonder feel like opposites. Wonder, to me, feels free. It feels vast. And meaning, on some level, feels caged. It feels small. It feels tight. It feels somehow limited at its own attempts at a narrative. It has to define reality. It has to give it an arc. It has to give it a start and an end. Right? And wonder doesn't need to do that. So what's the meaning of life feels like an incarcerating kind of question, doesn't it? It feels incarcerating to me. We only ask that question when we're not free. So in your own life, think about the times when you maybe have asked yourself that question. What's the meaning of my life? What am I doing here? What's my purpose? What's the point of all this? Think about the times when you've wrestled with these kind of great existential questions. How are you feeling? How are you feeling when you ask those questions? What circumstance caused you to ask those? What experience caused you to ask those? And when you were wrestling with those questions, how did you feel while you were doing it? Were you getting more and more free, or were you getting bound more tightly? So for me, because I don't know how it was for you, but for me, when I have asked in my own life, even demanded of the great universe, what the meaning of life was, I was usually in pain, even despair. And for me, what's the meaning of life actually meant? I'm scared. I'm really scared right now. I am scared that there is no purpose to my life. I'm scared there's no purpose to me. I feel fear, despair, hopeless. I'm scared I'm unimportant. I'm scared my life doesn't matter. I'm scared maybe I'm unlovable. Maybe I'm ashamed. So that's actually the ground of my experience. And how it shows up is, maybe if I ask a question and get an answer, it will take away this feeling. Right? If somebody says, oh, this blankety blankety blank is part of a larger narrative and therefore blankety blankety blank. What I'm actually wanting when I ask for meaning is I want to be soothed. I'm in pain and I want to be soothed. I want to feel that I matter. I want to feel I belong. I want to feel seen, heard, valued, loved. That's actually all that's going on. It's very, very simple. I say simple because, you know, this is something we feel when we're 6 months old. This is basic, standard human stuff, right? We never outgrow this. We get more sophisticated at covering it. We get way more sophisticated in couching it in some sort of advanced, if I can find the answer and truly penetrate Camus' The Stranger, then I will have understood the great cosmic. And it's like, I feel lonely. I'm scared. There's nothing more complicated than that going on. It's very difficult for us to bear witness to that, but that's actually all that's happening. At least for me, that's what was happening. So let's remember that meaning is a word that is used in a lot of different ways. It's understood in a lot of different ways. And trusting that something has inherent value, trusting that something has inherent meaning, and needing to know what that meaning is and to measure it, ooh, those are two really different things. Those are two really different things. And I get caught myself in wanting to know, what is the narrative? What is the meaning? How valuable is it? How do I measure it? And that's, to me, the fool's errand. That doesn't need to happen. I can trust that I belong. That's something else. That, to me, really feels different. So when Zen says, no meaning, we're not talking about nihilism. We're not talking about... We're not saying that things have no value, no purpose. Life is meaningless, therefore everything's pointless. That's not what we're saying. That's quite the opposite of Zen, actually. We're saying life has all meanings, and so it's never limited by any of them. No matter what that narrative is that you have, no matter what that theory on your life is, fine, great. It's too small. It's much, 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 much bigger than that. It's the night sky again. Right? My idea about how many stars I'm seeing, my idea that I've been taught in science class about how many light years that star is away from me and how long it takes the light here to get me and ha-da-da-da-da, all those things are a little too small, aren't they? My actual experience that's moving in my chest is going to be way, way, way bigger than all those ideas. So no meaning is like Bodhidharma's nothing holy. When the emperor of China asked Bodhidharma, what's the truth of your holy teaching? Vast emptiness, nothing holy. That's not nihilism. Bodhidharma is pointing to something really, really important, and that's what no meaning is pointing to, too. He knows as soon as we have a holy, we have a not holy. Ta-da! Welcome to dualism. That's what the ego does best. Again, very important function, not your enemy. We need it. But as soon as we have a holy, we have a not holy. As soon as we have meaningful, we have not meaningful. You have a meaningful activity, you have a meaningless activity. You have a meaningful relationship with a meaningful person, Now you have meaningless relationships with meaningless people. Got it? Right? Ta-da! That's why we go right back where we started, right? Meaningful is personal, subjective, always changing. It's a totally relative value. It's absolutely a relative judgment. We're making a judgment. We're making a judgment. Ugh. That's what gets so dangerous. We're making a judgment. I see this in myself all the time. I just see this in myself all the time. As many times as I've been told, nothing holy, nothing holy, nothing holy. It's like the mantra of Zen, right? Nothing holy, nothing holy. Don't separate. Don't separate. We don't bow and we enter the Zendo because this is the great sacred space. It's a mindfulness activity. Put your palms together. How do those warm things feel when you put them together? Start your intention. Start your meditation when you enter the door. Why do you bow when you leave? Because now that's the sacred space. Now you're leaving. You're going to that sacred space. Great. Then when you leave the building, now you're going to that sacred space, right? No division. Wow, nothing holy. And I still see myself being really, really picky about how this room looks. Right? Like, oh, man, those cushions, that one's backwards. No, the tag goes in the back. The tag goes in the back. I'm still caught by it. I'm still caught by it. Oh, I love this room. I have such affection for it. How long does it take me to turn I have affection and kindness and care for into holy? And as soon as this is the holy room, then that's the not holy room. And as soon as you're the holy person, I've got a not holy person. And man, the difference between not holy and now you don't matter to me takes about that long. It just doesn't take any time at all. We can even fight over whose room is most holy. Is it the room here? We call MZMC, or is it the room right down the street called Greek Orthodox? Which is holier? Do we even want to pull at that string? We all know where that goes. We all know exactly where that goes. Nothing holy is a really important teaching. And so no meaning, nothing holy, all this is central to Zen, and it's pointing to reality being undivided. Reality is being undivided. And what that actually means is we recognize the mind's ability to create division as useful shorthand. It's temporarily helpful for me to think of me as me. Right? Me is me. Oh, look, Ted is Ted. Guy is Guy. We're all different. I'm going to go home in my, motorcycle today because the weather's nice. He'll go home in his truck. Cool. Separate. But it's really helpful for me to know on some level that's just a fiction. It's really important that I know that. It's really important I know that. Because as much as Zen teaches there's nothing holy, it also teaches there's no place to spit. I really can't start spitting in the non-Zendo because it's not the Zendo. I really can't start treating you as something less than respect because you're not fill in the blank. So no meaning, like nothing holy, just means unlimited, infinite. And this is where Zazen comes in. This is where Zazen comes in. Let your Zazen practice take you beyond meaning. It already is. You already do that. When you came here this morning and you sat for 40 minutes and ideas of self came up, you let them go and you went back to experience. And plans for later today and the weekend came up and you let them go and you came back. And memories of yesterday came up and you let them go and you came back. You came back to something that is inherently undivided. Right? You went from self to no self. You went from divided to non-divided. You went from small to big, if you want to look at it that way. Right away, you're going beyond Buddha. You're going beyond Zen. You're not instructed to sit there and think really deep thoughts about Zen. No, let that go too. Zen's made up. Pitch it when it shows up, right? When it shows up in your meditation, pitch it. Meaning shows up, pitch it. Plans for tomorrow's dinner party, pitch it. Lofty ideas about the nature of the cosmos, pitch it. It's too small. It's too small. Right? Trust your actual experience. Your actual experience. This felt that Suzuki talked about. Felt. We feel. Because if we have meaning, then it can be taken from us. Right? If my job makes my life meaningful, what happens when I retire? My marriage makes my life meaningful, what happens when my wife dies? Being a parent gives my life meaning, what happens when my kids grow up? We see this in each other. We see this in ourselves all the time, don't we? How difficult it is to survive divorce, to survive death, to survive retirement, to survive. We kind of freak out. We think our lives are that small. When that thing goes away, we freak out. Of course we do, right? We're scared. We're right back where I started from. I'm scared. But with no meaning, nothing can be taken from you. It's all yours. That's what Zazen's for. We practice this every day. We practice choosing nothing. We choose nothing in Zazen. I don't choose this over that. I choose nothing. I just return. And when I practice choosing nothing, I get to be intimate with everything. I get to be intimate with everything because I'm not choosing anymore. It's what Tim said a couple weeks ago. Since all is empty, all is possible. Since all is empty, all is possible. Is that what you said?
Sounds pretty good.
There's nothing better than quoting Tim to Tim because he doesn't know. So there's a lovely blog attached to the NPR radio show On Being. Some of you know, I'm sure, On Being, the show by Krista Tippett. And a lot of you know the name Parker Palmer as well. I'm sure he's a Quaker. Writer, retreat leader. He's an amazing contemplative. And he said recently in the On Being blog, when I am sure I know exactly what I'm doing and why, so sure that I miss vital clues about what's really needed and about what I have to offer, it's a sure sign that my ego is in charge, and that's dangerous. My best offerings come from a deeper, more intuitive place that I can only call my soul. Embracing the fact that there is no way to know with precision whom or what I am serving helps free me from the ego's dominion. And then he finishes by saying, all that's in my power are my own intentions and my willingness to give myself to them. I just think that's lovely. All that's in my power are my own intentions and my willingness to give myself to them. That just feels freeing to me. That's just freeing. Meaning, not a player. Intentions and my willingness to give myself to them. There's no measuring there. That feels like trusting. There's no evaluation there. There's no needing to know. This is just, right? Surrender to the process. And that's our bodhisattva vows. You know those vows we chant? If they're new to you, you'll chant them today at the end of the talk. They're on the front of your program. Our intentions, our willingness to give ourselves to them is what that's all about. They go out of their way to point out these things are inconceivable. Don't start measuring progress or you're in big trouble. You're in really, really big trouble if you start measuring. You can't measure. It's too big. They're infinite. Our intentions, our willingness to give themselves to them, the results of those actions, what they mean, none of our business. We do not actually get to know in this life what we actually did. We do not ever actually find out, are we good boys or good girls? Bad boys, bad girls? We don't get to find out. We really don't. The effects of our actions are infinite. That's why we don't get to know. We don't actually get to know. We never actually know the impact we have on the universe because our impact is infinite. Our lives are created by every other life in the universe, past, present, and future. And they affect every other life in the universe, past, present, and future. This is dynamic, unfolding, so we don't ever get to find out. We do not get to be successes or failures. Isn't that freeing? It is to me. I so badly want to be good. I so badly want to be good, and that comes from a fear of being bad. And when someone says, you don't get to find out, that actually is freedom. It feels like freedom to me. I don't have to worry about the evaluation anymore. The universe isn't evaluating me. The night sky was not evaluating me. Only I was evaluating me, right? That's all that's actually happening. It's a reflection of my own mind. So not getting to find out feels good to me. No seed ever sees the flower. So when Tim says that the Bodhisattva vows are inconceivable, that's what he means. Literally impossible to know. Literally impossible to know. So the question to the Zen student is, can we just rest in our intention? Can we just rest in our willingness to offer ourselves to those intentions? Can we just do our best to help and stop trying to measure the worth? Can we sit just to sit? Stop trying to measure the progress. Can we love just to love? And stop trying to always leave part of ourselves out to keep it safe, save it for later. One of the quotes on the front of your program today is from a poem. It doesn't matter whether he knows what he serves. Who serves best doesn't always understand. And I think that's beautiful, and I think it sounds like Zen. Our needing to know can be wonderfully helpful to us sometimes, and other times it can be terribly binding. Our needing to know can be terribly binding for us if we're not careful. What if I can't do anything until I know what it means, until I know where it goes? I will not get on that road until I know where it ends up. I'm already paralyzed. I'm not going to take that job until I know what it's going to look like and feel like in 5 years. Good luck, seriously? I'm not going to go on a date with you until I know where this is going to end. Really? I'm not going to have a kid until I know that they're going to become a lawyer someday? Really? We never get to know. That's the way the universe is arranged. Of course we serve best we don't already understand. And Zen teaches us, like, in order for me to get on that road, if I have to know where it's going, I recognize that I'm locked up. And Zen does this really, really well because it teaches us all the time that every road only goes to itself. A road doesn't go to someplace. It's a road. It's it. That's it. It goes to itself. It's not a means to an end. It's a road. We know this because of Zazen. Well, if I sit Zazen, where will I end up? There's not a teacher in the world who's any good at anything who'd say, oh, I know exactly where that's going to go. If you do this every day, here's what your life is going to look like in 10 years. Forget it. You'll get enlightenment. Really? Nobody knows. Of course not. You sit Zazen to sit Zazen. It is not a means to an end. What Zazen does is nothing. It does nothing. What is it good for? Nothing. What does it mean? Nothing. Isn't it nice to give yourself for 40 minutes a day to an activity that's absolutely meaningless? It is. It's no more meaningless than driving to work. If you think about it. Can you imagine a Zazen that was so small it meant something? You, right? I prefer my Zazen to be boundless and to mean nothing. Why? Because Zazen's too big. It's too big to mean anything, you guys. It's too big to mean anything. Just like your life. It's too big to mean anything. Any story, any meaning, any value, any metric you attach to it will be too small. It'll bind it. It'll cage it. And your life is not in jail. There is no boundary. Your life is way too big. The field of boundless emptiness is what exists from the very beginning, our ancestor Hongzhe says. In fact, that's the very first sentence of his very first practice instruction, now that I think of it. The field of boundless emptiness is what exists from the very beginning. Everything else he writes rests on that one sentence. And from his point of view, from his Zen point of view, that's the thing you trust. That's like fantastic. Boundless emptiness. Any idea that shows up, fine, who cares? Throw it into infinity. All those ideas work, and none of them work. Absolute freedom there. Thank goodness there isn't some small meaning. Oh, as long as you sit Zazen every day, your life's meaningful. Ah! Does that feel small to you? Can you feel it? What's the meaning of the boundless field? No meaning. And if the whole question, if this whole question of meaning is still sticky for you, to be a little less abstract, ask yourself some questions. Just ask yourself, what do your friendships mean? What do they mean? What do your kids mean? I mean, look at your kid in the eyes when you see him. I just go, what do you mean? Are you meaningful? Is this meaningful? Are you... Right? What does the sunrise mean you saw it this morning? What does it mean? It seems like a silly question, right? We're actually asking this of our life. Where's the meaningful part? Do you see how by dissecting the frog we're killing it? Right? What does the sunrise mean? What does the face of infinity in that clear night sky mean? I couldn't find anything big enough that it wouldn't shoot right back at me. What does a rainbow mean? What does a duck mean? Right? No meaning, just a duck. What does a piece of string or a magnet mean? What does a grandmother mean? No meaning, just a grandma. Both my grandmas are dead, but I think of my one grandma every day. She lives inside me. We're still very much in relation with one another. And when I think of her face and how it looked whenever she saw me, and I ask, what does that grandma mean? That's a hilarious question. Because it's like, are you freaking kidding me? It's grandma. She's way too big to fit inside any tiny... Oh, come on. Meaning? No, it's like, oh, grandma, I know where you keep the lemon cookies. I love you so much. The actual scope of grandma repels any attempt to cage her with meaning. The actual scope of your life repels any attempt to cage it with meaning. The actual scope of anything, the recorder, the microphone, piece of paper, cup, your breath, repels any attempt to cage it with meaning. So, to wrap up, your Zazen is none of your business. I'm fond of quoting that. It's Katagiri Roshi, our founder. Your Zazen is none of your business. I agree with that. I agree with that. And I would add that your love, none of your business. Your life is none of your business. And the reason is because your life isn't yours. And it isn't about you. Any more than your Zazen, it's not yours. It's not about you. And right upstairs, actually right up there, Katagiri once advised one of his students to pray. And the student was puzzled and asked him, whom do I pray to? And Katagiri said, it doesn't matter. When you pray, just pray. So the suggestion that Zen offers us, the invitation that Zen extends, is to give up the good for the great. Right? No meaning, just life. If I'm caught by meaning, I'm not alive. Don't let it be small. Right? Suzuki Roshi once said, just to be alive is enough. Just to be alive is enough. Do you believe him? Just to be alive is enough. And the invitation here at Zen Center is to stay quiet long enough, to stay still long enough, that we get to feel what he meant. We really get to taste what he meant. We get to know what he meant. Just to be alive is enough. Right? No meaning, just life. Thank you. Thank you very much. And actually, we're doing good on time today, so if anybody'd like to offer some thoughts, that'd be lovely. Benton?
42,
yes. For those of you Douglas Adams fans, the meaning of life is 42, and I very, very, very carefully did not include that on my talk, because I went, what would I do with the other 40 minutes? I mean, good morning, welcome to Zen Center, 42, I'll see ya. Are you guys Douglas Adams fans? The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Universe? All right. Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Other folks? Please, Jeremy.
I want to thank you for sharing your feelings and experiences. It reflects a lot of what was inside of me from time to time.
Yeah.
And it's very personal, very touching. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. You're very welcome, yeah. Yeah, it's, I was telling my wife last night, you know, I'm a little uncertain about tomorrow's talk. And she said, well, yeah, but you say that every time you're going to get a talk. Yeah, come to the territory, that sounds right. She said, especially so? I said, well, yeah, because I'm going to tell them life has no meaning. And she went, well, why would you tell them that? Well, because I'm trying to crack them open to something even bigger than meaning. She went, oh, geez, yeah, well, I'm sure it'll go fine. It's fun to talk about, but it's... The reason I'm telling that is because there's a... When I look back on the times when I've asked that question with great... great sincerity. It is a question worth asking. And I honestly don't know if when I was in a really, really despairing, tough, dark place, that the no meaning, just life answer would have been helpful. Honestly, I don't think it would have been. I think what I needed, and that's why I kind of went there, was somebody to say, sweetie, you're okay. You'll get through this. I love you. That's it. And you don't need to put your life in some sort of narrative. Oh, your life's not meaningful because you don't have a really important job. You know, to try to comfort me that way wouldn't have been helpful, but just to say, I see you. I know what that's like to feel that way. I'm sorry. I love you. I mean, I think that's really what I would have needed. So, yeah, we sometimes have to be careful with, you know, some of the more abstract, sort of trippy things, because sometimes they're really, really helpful for us when we're hanging on to an abstraction, even in spiritual. It sounds really lofty and really good, and it's like, nah. This is covering over something really basic. And we also have to be careful of thinking, you know, that one size fits all, because these teachings are just these teachings. You know, when these talks resonate with you, great. When they don't, pitch them. I mean, they're just made up. So, thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah. Please, Raymond.
Again, thank you. I just want to say it reminded me of something that I'm reading lately, the difference between meaning. And understanding.
Yeah.
Where knowledge is something, okay, I got it, there's nothing more to do about it, and understanding just flows all over,
yeah.
And you get deeper and deeper and deeper, and if you just, yeah. Meaning seems to be kind of like knowledge.
Okay, got it.
Nothing more to do.
Yeah. That's how I see it too. Yeah, I like that. I like that a lot. And I know these words, again, this is just words, we're playing with language, but it's a different way of knowing something, isn't it? Yeah. Yeah. Does that make sense to folks? Yeah. All right, well, thank you very much for your attention. And Guy, I'll turn it over to you, please.